SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Hello and welcome to NITV Radio. I'm Bertrand Tungandame. Coming up in your program this Monday, October 28th, like every Monday afternoon, we have current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective brought to us by NITV's NULA program. We also have an interview of Jasmine McCorkey about a new book, Words to Sing the World Alive, a book that celebrates First Nations languages from across the continent. And it's a book that brought together 40 First Nations writers and thinkers, journalists and lawyers, artists and astronomers to reveal their favorite and significant words. We also have a conversation with Lauren Miller of Original Power, talking about how organizations work supporting communities in remote areas of the NT switch to solar power. All these stories and more coming to you after the latest news on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, Indigenous Girls Education Project in Pilbara receives boost from Women's Fund. Questions asked over Qantas flight upgrades for politicians. And in football, the Matildas anticipating a tough match against Germany. A program that re-engages Indigenous girls in school in Western Australia has received a boost from a dedicated women's fund. The grant to the Punkaliara project in the Pilbara town of Roban has come from community funding provider 100 Women, which is a giving cycle where members donate money to a grant pool. The Punkaliara project aims to use film, animation, song and movement to build up storytelling and leadership skills and re-engage young women in education. Qantas flight upgrades for politicians is in the spotlight. It comes after Anthony Albanese reportedly requested free upgrades directly from the Qantas boss at the time, Alan Joyce, when he was Transport Minister. The allegation is made in a book by former Australian Financial Review columnist Joe Aston. Nine newspapers reports Mr. Albanese received at least 22 free upgrades over more than a decade. Mr. Albanese says he declared all the upgrades he received. Treasurer Jim Chalmers says he never personally asked former Qantas CEO Alan Joyce for an upgrade. Asked about whether he supports a strengthened process for the disclosure of interests, he says he hasn't had the chance to give extended thought to it.
You know, I'm broadly aware, and I was asked this morning
about some of these issues that yourself and Cameron have raised. It's appropriate that the arrangements are robust. I know that the Prime Minister was asked about this, I think, multiple times yesterday in his press conference. I don't have anything to add to it.
Tens of thousands of mobile phones and devices operating on the 3G network will stop working as the remaining major telecommunication companies begin switching off the 3G network. Telstra and Optus say the move is being made to boost the speed, capability and reliability of their 4G and 5G system. A range of technological devices will be impacted by the 3G shutdown, including older mobile phones that will no longer connect with emergency services and medical monitoring equipment. Federal Communications Minister Michelle Rowland says those who need their device upgraded should contact their service provider.
The 3G switchover is a commercial decision by mobile network providers, and the industry has undertaken significant efforts to identify and contact potentially affected customers and encourage them to check and upgrade their devices. My department will continue to work with the telcos during the 3G switchover process to ensure this occurs in a safe and well-managed way.
Optus says it has run a six-week awareness campaign and offered 20,000 no-cost handsets to select customers, including those experiencing financial challenges. The company says staff in store are trained to assist customers with the transition. The leader of the Queensland Liberal National Party, David Crisafulli, is set to be sworn in as the state's 41st Premier by State Governor Janet Young later today. He will become the LNP's first Queensland Premier since Campbell Newman's 2012-2015 stint, ending Labor's time governing Queensland for 30 of the past 35 years. With almost 70% of counting complete, the Queensland LNP is on track to claim 48 seats ahead of Labor's 28, with 12 still in doubt. That is one seat more than the 47 needed to form a majority government. Mr. Crisafulli campaigned consistently on no changes to his 19-member cabinet if elected. He says he wants to talk to MPs first before any final decision is made. And he says he's keen to enact this policy, his policy priorities, including a plan to increase sentences for youth offenders.
It's no ifs, buts or maybe. Making Queensland safer laws will be laws by Christmas. And that means there will be two sittings of Parliament to finish this year. I made a commitment to Queenslanders that there would be a committee process, even though we were taking that to the election. I just want to make sure that those laws have the opportunity to go through that process, but they will be laws by Christmas time.
Authorities in New South Wales have announced a $1 million reward for information on the murder of IT worker Prabha Kumar in Parramatta Park. 41-year-old Prabha Arun Kumar was fatally stabbed while he was walking through Parramatta Park in the city's west. She took a train home from work in Rhodes to Parramatta Railway Station and had been talking on the phone to her husband when the stabbing happened. Detective Superintendent Danny Doherty, the commander of Homicide Squad, says police will keep searching for Ms. Kumar's killer.
It's hard to talk about motive. We've still haven't been able to identify a person who will charge someone for this murder. What we can theorise is that we believe that it was a targeted attack on Prabha. We can almost exclude robbery as a motive, sexual-related attack. We can also exclude any bias attack. There's been no evidence of that.
Independent MP Helen Dalton says she is looking forward to debating the New South Wales Parliament on a new bill to regulate gambling companies. The bill has had its second reading speech in the lower house and will come up for debate again in the next week. Under the bill, a gambling company would be required to report to the Commissioner of Police if it has reason to suspect a person is paying for gambling services with money obtained illegally. Ms. Dalton says the proceeds should go back to the victims, not the gambling companies.
I think we all assume that the money goes back to the victims. That's the way we think life is, but in the gambling world it's not. So this will really put the shine a light on this issue and hopefully get some fairness in the judicial system.
West Australia has been named the best performing state economy for the first time in a decade. The state topped Comsec's State of States report, which gauges their economic performance and momentum based on 8 indicators. The October quarter report shows the resource-rich state has come first in retail spending, relative unemployment and population growth. Comsec chief economist Ryan Feltzman says higher interest rates are really affecting the southeastern states and territories. Despite being the largest state economy, New South Wales continues to languish at 7th spot. Victoria slipped one place down to 4th, despite leading on construction work done amid its big build projects, while Tasmania climbed to 5th and the Australian Capital Territory fell to 6th. And to sport in football, Matilda's defender Claire Hunt says the team is focusing on strengthening its defensive game as part of preparations against Germany. The friendly against world number 4 Germany early tomorrow morning at 4:10 a.m. comes after a 1-1 draw against Switzerland over the weekend. Australia lost in the last encounter against Germany in the Olympics, with Germany coming away with a 3-0 win. Hunt says Germany will be a tough opponent. And now, having a look at the weather around the country: Perth, a sunny day ahead, on a top of 32 degrees. Adelaide, cloud clearing, 24. Melbourne, partly cloudy, 17. Hobart, partly cloudy as well, and a top of 17 degrees. Canberra, mostly sunny day, 27. Wollongong, possible shower, 22. Sydney, becoming cloudy, 25. Newcastle, mostly sunny, 29. Brisbane, showers, 26. Cairns, a shower, 31. And Darwin, a shower, 2 as well, and a top of 36 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
Little bit of country and little bit of rock and roll, a beautiful song by the Fitzroy Express, an Indigenous Aboriginal country rock band from the remote Kimberley town of Fitzroy Crossing in Western Australia. I'm Bertrand Tungandami, and you're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Still to come in the program, we have an interview of Jasmine Makoki about a new book, What's to Sing the World Alive, a book that celebrates First Nations languages from across the continent. This book brought together actually 40 First Nations writers and thinkers, journalists and lawyers, artists, astronomers, well, women from all walks of life who came together to reveal their favorite and significant words. In the program, we also have a conversation with Lorraine Miller of Original Power, talking about her organization's work supporting communities in remote areas of the Northern Territory to switch to solar power. But first, like every Monday afternoon, we have a selection of current affairs stories from an Indigenous perspective brought to us by NITV's NOLA program. Mayors from Indigenous communities in Queensland say they are disappointed the Liberal National Party has backflipped on its support for the treaty and truth-telling process. Ahead of last weekend's state elections, the Liberals in Queensland had vowed to quickly scrap the First Nations Treaty Institute if they win. Dan Rennie reports.
Meeting in Meanjin, Brisbane, the Indigenous Leaders Forum expressed united support for the truth-telling and healing inquiry. Bruce Simpson is mayor of Cherbourg, a former Aboriginal mission. He says community members are looking forward to telling their stories.
We are privileged and we were blessed from our elders from Cherbourg and our community to lead the way and to accept the truth-telling and healing inquiry team to come on country and to hear the stories of our elders.
And he says despite the LNP's promise to scrap the healing inquiry if it wins Saturday's election, the truth will be told, no matter who is in power.
Government does not dictate our truth, so it doesn't matter who's in the political power of, you know, and will lead our communities, we will still tell our truth.
Further north, in the Gulf Country, Doomadgee locals are frustrated with the opposition's tough-on-crime stance while they go without the basics in the tiny town.
Our house is overcrowded. Our people are getting sicker. Our people are left dying in hospital. Nobody's supporting us. Our people are going to jail at a younger age. You know why? Because there's nothing there for them. They're talking about employment. This government pour money into employment. They don't need Doomadgee. Doomadgee get nothing out of them.
Latest polls have the LNP favourite to form government, 53% to 47% on a two-party preferred basis. Dan Rennie, NITV News.
Well, the elections elections were held on Saturday, and the LNP actually won that poll. Now, police in New South Wales have launched a fresh appeal for any information to help solve the murders of three Indigenous children more than 30 years ago. Detectives have spent the week camped out at a local hall in Barraville, declaring a $1 million reward for any information that leads to an arrest.
Colleen Walker, 16 years old, described as a bright, outgoing sister and daughter, presumed murdered in September 1990 after leaving a party in Bowraville. Her clothes were later discovered weighted down in Nambuka River. Her body has never been found. 3 decades on, her family desperate for answers.
I want to know, you know, I don't want to leave this earth not without knowing where she is. I want to have something of hers so that I know that she came home. And look, like I said, I just want people who know things just to come forward.
Her murder, as well as that of Colleen's 4-year-old cousin Evelyn Greenup and 16-year-old Clinton Speedy Duro, whose bodies were both found in bushland, were originally investigated separately before being linked by the homicide squad more than 7 years later.
But it's got to be significant and fresh, strong evidence to ask to warrant another search. And it's frustrating, for everyone, that the remains are still haven't been located.
Like, we deserve to bring her home. Like, her spirit's wandering and we have no closure. We want justice, not only for Colleen but for the other 2 children as well.
A man who cannot be named for legal reasons was charged on separate occasions over 2 of the children's murders, but has since been acquitted.
It's important for us to be here to let the family know and the community know that we haven't forgotten.
Police are now focusing on finding Colleen Walker's body and are now stationed at the Bowraville Hall, announcing a $1 million reward for any information leading to an arrest or conviction. A small price for the immeasurable cost the families have endured.
Parks Australia has been fined $200,000 for damaging a sacred men's site in Kakadu National Park. The decision, handed down in a special on-country sitting of the Northern Territory Local Court, finalises a long-running legal battle brought by traditional owners who are celebrating the outcome as a win for the ongoing protection of country and culture. Emma Kellaway reports.
It's a place renowned for its natural beauty, but for the Jawin people, Gunlum Falls also holds a deep cultural significance.
Bull is the creation spirit for this area, so part of the 3 clans' obligation to this country is to look after those bull sites, because they're not only important ceremony sites to the Jawin people, but to the surrounding tribes across the top end.
Those responsible for protecting it celebrating a win.
It's a good day for family to come back and make plans to work together with parks.
For me, having our rights considered, our obligations as traditional owners considered.
It's the outcome of a 5-year-long legal battle over damage done to a sacred men's site while constructing an unapproved walking track in 2019. The judgment.
The defendant is convicted of the charge. I impose a fine of $200,000.
A moment met with emotion on both sides. Parks Australia now looking to reconcile and find a way forward.
Completely accept the judgment handed down today.
I culturally and personally and now professionally will be doing as much as I can to ensure we learn the lessons from these examples.
The historic ruling, a way of strengthening laws for the protection of cultural heritage.
It sets a precedent. It sends a clear message to government, statutory corporations, but also, as the judge said, anyone proposing to do work in the Northern Territory.
Goonlam is one of the most pristine attractions for visitors to Kakadu. Considerations are now turning to when it will be reopened after being closed for more than 5 years.
Then we can look to opening up, hopefully in the new year after the wet.
New beginnings for a meeting place used for millennia. Emma Kellaway, NITV News.
And that's all for stories brought to us by NITV's NOLA program. We must now step aside for a break. When we come back, we explore a new book that will be released tomorrow, a book that explores language by 40 deadly First Nations women.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
That was Dreamtime Stories, a song by Coloured Stone. This is a song that's a poignant reminder, actually, of the cultural significance of the Dreamtime and its continued relevance to Aboriginal communities today. It serves as a bridge between past and present, connecting listeners to the rich heritage and wisdom of Aboriginal Australia. Coming up next, as promised, going to be talking about a book, a new book that explores First Nations languages across the country. Shortly before the program, I caught up with one of the editors of this groundbreaking publication.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Words to Sing the World Alive is a book that celebrates First Nations languages from across the continent. The book was edited by Jasmine McGoke and The Poet's Voice. In this book, 40 First Nations writers and thinkers, journalists and lawyers, artists and astronomers came together to reveal their favorite and significant words. Words that are imbued with family and belonging and that surprise with their connections. Jasmine McGoke, first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, ahead of the release of Words to Sing the World Alive, a series that celebrates First Nations languages from across the continent, what inspired you to co-edit and commission this collection?
I can't take credit for coming up with the idea. It was The Poet's Voice. They had been a part of a couple of events in Victoria about sharing language and poetry and things like that. And they reached out to me and I got to see transcript of those original events, the poetry and the pieces that were spoken out loud. It caught my attention and I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to see how something that was a spoken word event could turn into a book.
And there are some very, very powerful authors and artists in this project. Some of them are familiar to us on NITV Radio, like Jazz Monet and Terry Junkie was on the air recently promoting things completely different. Was talking about cybersecurity or something in that sense. Really quite a diverse range of authors and topics to cover. Can you share a particularly meaningful word or phrase from your Torres Strait Islander heritage that you considered including in the collection? And also maybe share with us one or two stories that you also think stand out in the collection? Or maybe just you would like to point to us because it's a huge and everything is worth actually exploring. Yeah.
Of course, yeah. That's something that we talked about. We wanted readers to be able to pick up the book and read it from front to back, but also to pick it up and flip to the middle and be able to read from there. It's really, really hard to choose a favorite or a standout, but I would say the first piece by Auntie Rose
is really important to me because it talks about listening and about what you do with what you listen and the knowledge that you gain from listening to others. And I think it sets up the book really beautifully because it kind of makes you think about what you're going to do with this information that comes through the rest of the book. And I think in the Laughter pieces by Amy Toonies and Timur Ball are also really important to me because Amy's piece talks about giving and reciprocity, and I think it's a wonderful way to finish the collection. And Timur Ball's poem writes about the tension between language and English and how we transcribe them. So I think it's really an important note to end on and a powerful one to end on as well.
Coming back to the selection, you co-edited. What was the process of selecting and working with the 40 diverse contributors?
It was really difficult. We had a long list of people who we wanted to contribute. I mean, honestly, I think this book could have been three times as long as it is. We could have spoken forever with it. The process was, once we reached out, we talked to the contributor and really kind of give them free rein on what they wanted to do. They could write an essay, a poem. I think what was really interesting was a couple of them. With Auntie Rose's piece, the first one, special to me because it started off as a paragraph that she started, and then we had a conversation, the two of us, and it was about me kind of writing down what she said. So I thought it was a really beautiful kind of way of me listening to an elder, which is relevant to her piece, and writing down her words. Curly Saunders sent me voice notes at first. So for her piece, I heard it before I got to read it, which was really special, I think.
As a past participant in the Black and Right, how did the experience with Black and Right influence your approach to this project?
Black and Right is one of my favorite things to talk about. So I was an intern there, and it gave me the best introduction into publishing and specifically into editing First Nations work. It emphasized the importance of culture, and it made me realize that the process of editing was more about just giving feedback on the page. It's about the collaboration between the editor and the person and making sure that the space is safe for the writer so that the best piece can kind of come out. And sometimes that means that things aren't included in the piece, and sometimes that means that time needs to be taken and deadlines need to be readjusted so that the content is culturally appropriate and the writer feels safe and able to do their best work.
And the theme, of course, is language, and one really key element in language, First Nations languages, is preservation. How do you think this anthology will contribute to the preservation and revitalization of First Nations languages?
Yeah, I think revitalization has been happening. I mean, it's been happening a long time before this collection. To me, it just felt like a book that was just giving space for First Nations people to write what they wanted, what we wanted, and what we wanted our people to read. I think it's just a snapshot in a moment of time, and it relates to lots of people's experiences in learning their language or teaching their language. Yeah, it was really powerful to me. It kind of was uplifting and a bit scary because it made me realize what I don't know and what I'd love to know.
Do you see the anthology being used in educational settings like schools or even
There are so many different ways to read and understand these pieces and to analyze them. And I'd love to see how young people see these words and the moments and feelings connected to them.
Yeah. It's a massive project, which is, you know, just 40 authors, and you said multidisciplinary, and they use different mediums to communicate. What challenges did you encounter, and what are the most rewarding parts of working on such a massive project?
I think that the hardest part was choosing how to go about asking people to contribute. Obviously, you would know there are so many languages
within Australia, and we wanted to represent as many as possible. It wasn't possible in a book that could only hold 40 people's voices.
Yeah.
But so that was the hardest part, I think, having to accept that we couldn't have 500 different contributions. But the most rewarding part was working with the contributors and having them happy with their piece. And now seeing the book, you know, I have a copy and the contributors have their copy, and seeing them hold it, it's so special.
And did you see any surprising connections? You mentioned some really important, well, because all of them are important, of course, you mentioned it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned some really key ones. Were there any surprising connections or themes that emerged across the different works?
There were. You know, people talked about family and land.
Yeah.
A lot, which to me are also very important. And I found it interesting the different ways people kind of approach those topics.
And finally, because I know you're busy and I can't hold you for a very long time, I could ask you a million questions. As both an author and editor, how was working on this project? How has this project influenced your own writing and understanding of First Nations languages?
I think it inspired me. There was a lot of people in this collection who were very inspiring to me, who are very motivating. And I was so scared to reach out to a lot of people because I admire them so much. And so reading it and seeing the book in a physical format now only makes me want to do this again or to contribute myself to a similar type of book.
What's the release date so you can put it out there so people can get their copy as soon as possible?
Yeah, let me just get that. Make sure I get the right book. So it'll be out on the 29th of October, but it's available for pre-order now.
Yeah. Anything you'd like to add to the conversation we may have missed?
No, that's it. But thank you so much for asking these questions and being interested in the book. I hope people love it.
No, I'll definitely check it out when it's released. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on NITV Radio today. It's been really a great pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
That was Jasmine Magoki, editor of this groundbreaking book that will be launched tomorrow. We must now go to another break, but stay with us because when we come back, we'll be joined by Original Power's Lauren Mellor talking about their projects to help remote communities in the Northern Territory transition to clean energy. Stay tuned.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Clean, reliable and affordable electricity in remote communities, especially in the Northern Territory, that is the focus of Original Power. Original Power is a community-focused Aboriginal organisation that builds the collective power of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, backs their leadership, skills and capacity to genuinely achieve self-determination in their community and on country. And we are now joined by Lauren Mellor, who is Clean Energy Communities Coordinator. Lauren is Clean Energy Communities Coordinator. Lauren has close to 2 decades experience working in community development and organizing capacities with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities in the Northern Territory and Queensland to implement self-determined solutions to complex community needs. Lauren is now joining us on NITV Radio. Lauren, hello, and thank you so much for taking your time to talk to us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Our pleasure. Lauren, can we please start by, if you can please tell us who your people are, where you come from?
I'm non-Indigenous Shaka, so I was born and raised in Western Queensland. My family heritage is Irish, and I, from a very young age, have been interested in the very long history in Indigenous cultures and Indigenous resilience, and have been really inspired growing up by a whole range of very strong First Nations leadership, particularly in Queensland, through the land rights struggle, through the struggle for stolen wages to be returned, for justice around policing, and through that sort of education through these social movements, I came to be involved in community development work with First Nations people in communities that has led me to working in the Northern Territory. And I've worked right throughout the Northern Territory from Alice Springs up to Darwin. Yeah, I've just had the pleasure of working with so many fantastic, strong leaders, elders and communities over that time who are really committed to self-determination and deciding what happens on their country and determining the future of their communities. So that work has led me to now working in partnership with a range of communities who can see the opportunities that clean energy and the global transition to renewables presents. And there are so many opportunities in terms of the growth of this sector, both in terms of industrial development, but also in terms of potential climate and emissions reduction solutions that First Nations people, by and large, really want to be a part of this transition and to lead that where it's happening on their own land. And so that's where our work through Original Power has intersected with communities who are really both at the forefront of some of the climate challenges that we're seeing here now in Australia with extreme heat impacting the livelihoods and the future of many, many communities, particularly in the north of Australia, and also communities wanting to be part of leading those climate solutions through renewable energy so that they can provide affordable, fair, sustainable energy to their own communities.
Hmm. And so what is the situation in the communities at the moment?
Here in the Northern Territory, we've got a pretty dire situation in terms of energy access and equity. We have 10,000 First Nations households who access electricity through a mandated prepaid meter arrangement, which for those that don't know about this system, it requires an energy customer to usually top up using an app or a card. Similar to how you would prepay for a mobile phone, you would go and purchase essentially a voucher at the local store and then you'd go and top up the credit on your meter at your house. But when that credit expires, the home de-energises and you lose access to everything from lights to fans to air conditioning to the ability to charge any appliance. And this has really devastating flow-on impacts for those households. Recent data out of the Northern Territory led by the Australian National University shows that once every 4 days on average, First Nations customers are being disconnected from power for an average of 8 hours or more. And this has incredibly disruptive impacts on those households, from health impacts for people being exposed to extreme heat or cold during that time, through to impacts on schooling, workforce participation, hygiene, the ability to simply to wash clothes, bedding, or to have a hot shower. So there are a whole range of impacts, and by and large, the data on these disconnections is not being properly recorded or reported on. So prepaid meter customers are largely an invisible cohort of energy customers living in extreme financial hardship with disrupted access to energy. And we know that energy is fundamental to anybody or any community being able to self-determine what happens in their future and in their daily lives. And it's a precursor to any form of social and economic well-being. So that's why we've started working with these communities who are experiencing this extreme energy insecurity to look at how we can harness the power of renewable energy to bring costs down for people and to put power back in the hands of those communities so they can start to see those improvements at a household and community level from having access to affordable energy.
What is the role of Original Power? How do you start working with the community?
Original Power started working in this space around 5 years ago when we saw the impacts of energy insecurity on the communities that we were working in partnership with around other community development objectives. We could see that the constant disruptions to access to power held such a negative space in people's lives and really held people back from being able to fully participate in the life of community. And by looking at what those structural barriers were that were preventing people from being able to access regular and affordable energy and then also renewable energy. And one of the big barriers at that point was the fact that people did access power through a prepayment meter. And that really at the time was said to not be compatible with rooftop solar, and so prepayment customers were automatically locked out of being able to choose or benefit from rooftop solar in the way that 3 million other Australian households currently do. So we knew that the prepayment meter needed to be better understood, and the way that it could integrate with renewables needed to be better understood. And so we spent a bunch of time in research and design, working with the meter manufacturers themselves, working with the retailer and the network and utility operators in the Northern Territory. We ran a trial of a single household in Tennant Creek and integrated rooftop solar with that meter, and could see that the meter was able to operate by recognising when solar was producing on the rooftop and when it needed to draw from the grid. So that process took nearly a year before that household was able to officially connect. But when it did, we were able to demonstrate to all of those key policymakers and decision makers that prepaid meter customers shouldn't be automatically locked out of access to solar. Despite that, there are still obviously a number of barriers to prepayment customers being able to access rooftop solar, let alone any other form of renewable energy. The financial situation of many prepayment customers is one of extreme hardship, where there simply isn't extra money to invest in something like rooftop solar. And in many cases, people aren't obviously homeowners as well. And so those housing assets belong to or are leased to usually government or community housing providers. So there's really no ability or incentive for those people renting in those communities to invest in these assets or ability to. So there's still a whole range of barriers where we really need to see trials like the integration of prepaid meters with rooftop solar turned into supported government programs that actually do invest in improvements in terms of energy efficiency and renewables on Indigenous community and social housing in the Northern Territory in particular, where we know people are living in very energy insecure homes. We haven't yet seen any sort of commitment around improving access to renewables for those 10,000 households in the Northern Territory. But we are currently engaged in a study that's nationwide looking at all of the prepaid meter jurisdictions around Australia, what the impacts are on those largely First Nations households in those communities, and what the solutions are that communities understand themselves and would like the community and the energy sector in general to be pushing for. So that study is underway now and is due to report early next year. So we're really hoping that out of that we can lead with community-led solutions to the energy insecurity for prepaid meter customers.
And that was Lauren Miller of Original Power. As you heard at the beginning of the conversation, Lauren is not Aboriginal, but the company she works for, Original Power, is a community-focused Aboriginal organization that builds the collective power of its people, backs their leadership skills and capacity to genuinely achieve self-determination in community and on country.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
And that was Black Magic by Baker Boy. And that's all from us on NITV Radio this Monday afternoon. Thanks for your company today. I'm Bertrand Tungandami. Till next time, bye for now. Yaloo.